I'm grumpy. I'm an alcoholic.
Grumpy.
Most important thing I can share with you, it hadn't been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or do any mood or mind-altering chemicals since October 2nd in 1988. My home group is the Last Dog Group in Farmersburg, Indiana. It's a men's meeting. That way we don't get distracted with character defects of the opposite sex. You know, it's a real privilege and honor to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's great to see that Jamie's continued to try and grow in this program and do the right stuff. When he come around me, he had trouble with relationships. And I told him relationships were really exciting love affair, turns into outrageous nightmare, and sobriety hangs in peril. That's about all I know about relationships. So, you know, like I said, it's a privilege and an honor to come down here, you know, to Georgia. And Jim rode with me, you know, one of the guys from my home group. I do better when I got another guy with me, because left to my own devices and my own thinkings, even with this amount of years, I can still get in trouble. So I do better when I got another guy with me, and I don't travel alone if at all possible. My wife wanted to come and be here. She's a strong member of Al-Anon, and I'm real grateful for that. If it wasn't for the program of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous, we would not be together. You know, she went through all the drinking and drugging with me, and we were divorced for over 10 years before we remarried. So I'll tell you that story later on. But, you know, I guess I'm supposed to tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. I'm really not good on what it used to be like, you know. I think we all know what it used to be like. I could probably tell you my story real quick. I was a union iron worker for several years. I worked on the Sears Tower in Chicago. I had a lot of stalled jobs. You know, my drinking probably could be described in a story about an iron worker that worked over at St. Louis at Anheuser-Busch. And he was working on the overhead crane rails, and they had a big push about safety, so they wanted us to wear safety glasses. And when you're up there and it's hot and sweaty, your glasses will steam up. And usually we took them off, but because OSHA was there, they made us keep them on. And Joe was walking across the crane rail. His glasses steamed up, and he fell in a vat of beer and drowned. And the union steward had to go home and tell his wife, said, "Hey, I'm sorry that Joe fell in a vat of beer at work today and drowned." And she started crying. "Oh, my poor baby, he never had a chance. You know, he couldn't swim, da-da-da-da-da." And the union steward finally looked at her and says, "Well, he got out of the vat three times to pee." I see some of you drank the way that I drank. You know, I grew up in a small farming community of about 500 and in Illinois, southern Illinois. My dad was a union iron worker. He was also an alcoholic. My whole family were alcoholics, addicts, or outlaws. And that didn't make me an alcoholic right away, but when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born. My dad, due to his drinking, had to move from small farm town to Chicago, and we went to Chicago, and I ran away and tried to get back to southern Illinois, and I got locked up at 13 years old. And that's when drinking become a real vital part of my life. It continued. I didn't get drunk from 13 on, but I tried to. And, you know, I ended up going through high school, and they called me hillbilly, redneck, all them things, because I talked with a southern drawl at that time. And, you know, I just didn't feel like I fit in. Yet I could drink with the guys, and everything was cool. And it kept on that way, and then, I don't know, I run into a gal that tripped my trigger. She had everything I wanted, and we started dating in high school, and we ended up running away. Her stepfather was physically and sexually assaulting her, and when I was getting ready to graduate high school, she was 16, and we decided to run away and come down near Buddy's old stomping grounds. I got to meet Buddy and Joe earlier today at a meeting, and her grandparents were from Murphy, North Carolina. And we run away and come down here and ended up getting married in Gaffney, South Carolina, because we wasn't legal back then. And I got married in her brother's sport coat, and she got married in her sister-in-law's dress. And I took that gal to the gates of insanity and back. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I know 7 days after we were married, I was on my way to boot camp. And in that time, Vietnam was going strong, and I ended up in Vietnam. And, you know, it was pretty crazy. I drank alcohol and got into the dope over there pretty good because I was afraid. Of course, I didn't want nobody to know I was afraid, so I volunteered for all the crazy assignments that I could get and all the weird detachments I could get into and try to prove myself a man. That's one amends that I got to make somehow, someday, and with the help of my sponsor, I'm going to learn how to make that amends. He's already gave me some stuff to do on it. While I was in Vietnam, I got drunk. We come in off of a 6-day patrol and been doing them little white pills and drinking, and I stole the motorcycle off of an avant-garde and went to town. And when I got into the city of Dalat, I run over a Vietnamese boy and broke his leg. The bone was sticking out. And I got back up on a motorcycle and kick-started it and took off. And I left that kid there laying in the street screaming with bone sticking out of his leg. And they immediately moved me from that area to Nam because they had a contract out on me because of what I'd done. And those are some of the things that you can get into. You know, I took and ended up coming back after Vietnam, and I tried to do the right thing, and, you know, I wasn't drinking, wasn't drugging. I was just going through the motions. I was trying to be a dad. My oldest child was born at that time, my daughter, and I don't know who teaches you how to be a parent or to be a dad. I had a loving mother and a loving father, even though they had alcoholism, and my mom never drank, but she is a strong member of Al-Anon today. And Monday, when I get back, I get to celebrate her 84th birthday and get to take her to the hospital to have some tests done. And she's got some real fear about it, but she trusts her God. And she told me to come down here and do this and don't worry about her. And, you know, I'm grateful for Al-Anon for that fact. You know, I don't know, it's been a crazy ride. I got into, started going around AA in 1974. I took and hit a Chicago cop head on. Put our engines in the front seat with both of us, cut my lower lip completely off, And instead of calling my parents, I called the guy that run the tavern. I said, hey, come get me. And, you know, he took me to the hospital, and then the cops caught up with us there. And, you know, the cop that I hit was one of the good cops. He had let us do the stuff, and he helped, you know, he hustled pool with my dad and I and done a lot of stuff. He is one of the good cops. And, you know, I really had a lot of bad feelings for what I'd done to Bill. And, you know, through the amends steps, I've been able to take care of that kind of stuff. It took me 14 years. I hit AA my first time in 1974. And I came here and I was young, dumb, and thought I had all the answers. And I went to my first meeting in a Catholic church, St. Victor's in Chicago, and I'll be darned, you know, there's old-timers in there, and they was talking the stuff that I'd always heard at meetings, and they said, you know, if this ain't happened to you yet, you know, it could. If you continue to drink and do the stuff you're doing, and all them yets, and, you know, I found out them yets is you're eligible too, you know, because at that time I didn't quit. You know, I just went there to get the court card signed, and I left. I didn't, you know, there wasn't people there that I'd have drank and drugged with, to be honest with you. You know, they was old and had hair growing out of their ears and stuff, and I counted the holes in the ceilings, you know, when's this thing over, you know, and I couldn't wait to get gone. And, you know, when I got gone, it wasn't but a short time that I was back to doing the same stuff I'd been doing. I started running with a 1% motorcycle club at that time, doing some of the things that you ain't supposed to do, but they were my heroes, you know. Those were the guys that I looked up to at that time. Because when I come home from NOM, they're the only ones that didn't spit on me, didn't call me names and stuff, so I felt real comfortable with them guys. They gave me something that I did not find until I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. They gave me unconditional love. They didn't care what my name was, if I was rich, poor, or what. They wanted to know if I could do for them what they wanted me to do for them. And I could. And, you know, I did. I done a lot of things that I'm not proud of today, but that's part of my story, and that's it. You know, I've had to, that's where I'm so grateful for sponsorship today about them amends steps, you know. Everybody's so afraid of the damn steps, and to me, they're the most rewarding things that I've done. You know, I'm so grateful that when I finally came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 88 and said, I give, I surrender, that people were here that had the answer. I had to go through a lot of stuff to get to that point from 1974 to 1988. I got in several marriages and, you know, thinking that a woman would fix me, that the finances would fix me. Being a union iron worker, I made big money. I was a high-rolling connector. I'd set the steel buildings, and I could demand, you know, a couple dollars more over scale because I was doing a dangerous work, and I'd do it quick and do it. Had a lot of pride, you know, a lot of pride, and those are the things that got me in trouble. You know, I ended up getting in some real trouble, and I had to do one of them geographics in Alcoholics Anonymous. I left Chicago and I went to southern Indiana. The work in the steel mills and stuff had died down, and there wasn't no work, and there was a powerhouse going on in southern Illinois, and the union that I belonged to, they had a local in Terre Haute. So I went down there. My dad was already there. My mother was already there. The great thing about them already being there was my dad was also a union iron worker. They had a place to stay, so I was safe. I left Chicago to avoid flight, to avoid prosecution, really, and tried to run away to Indiana, and they eventually caught up with me because I didn't quit doing what I was doing once I got to Indiana. I changed people, places, and things, but all I did was really change the faces. They were the same type of people, same type of things, you know. And that's one thing that I reckon about Alcoholics Anonymous, is that you can change people, places, and things, but if they're still the same type of people, nothing changes. You know, that's the reason why I'm grateful for my sponsorship, who has taught me by his example. You know, I'm grateful for sponsorship that says, do as I do, not as I say. You know, and I am so grateful to my sponsor. I'm so grateful to the tapers. I was telling Buddy earlier today that there was some guys from Georgia and a gal from Georgia that I heard on tapes early in my recovery, because in a small farming community that I grew up in, at that time, there wasn't any meetings. You know, there you may have to road trip 20, 30 miles to hit a meeting. And, you know, so when I got into AA, I relied a lot on them tapes. An old guy by the name of Four Boar Rice from Stone Mountain, Georgia. Gal by the name of Judy Pierce from Atlanta. Those were some of the people that I listened to early on that I could identify with. And, you know, the tapers allowed me to do that. I got a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous in my area to be my sponsor. And he only had a couple more years sober than I did. But I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said, well, I don't know. He says, I heard about you. You're pretty crazy. He says, I'll tell you what, I'll give you rides to meetings. And that's the reason why I asked him to be my sponsor, quite frankly, is I live 20 miles away from Terre Haute, Indiana. They took my driver's license for 10 years, and it's getting towards winter. And I didn't like hitchhiking in the winter in the snow and the rain. And Dave agreed to be my sponsor. And he lived out near where I did, so he had pick me up and take me to meetings. And I'd call Dave up and catch a ride with him, and he'd talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd cuss him and AA all the way to the meeting. You don't understand, I'm different. And all this stuff. And you know what? That dude just kept on picking me up and taking me to meetings, and, you know, he got me to where I needed to be. We done the third step prayer and the fourth step in his living room. We got down on our knees in his living room, and I shared my stuff with him. And when we got done, he said, is that all of it? And there was some stuff that I didn't want to share, you know, about being molested, some other stuff that went on, and I started dumping some of that stuff with him. But the greatest thing that dude done was he started dumping some of his garbage with me, sharing some of his stuff with me that made me trustworthy, that I wasn't going to take what he shared with me and use it against him. And it enabled me to start to let go of some of that stuff that I was going to take to the grave with me. And Dave sponsored me for several more months. We got into, he had me go home with a sixth and seventh step and do it. And then when it come to the eighth and ninth step, Dave said, I can't take you no further because I have not gone any further. And I appreciate that man's honesty today, that he could not do what he had not been done himself. And he suggested that I take and get another sponsor, and I couldn't identify with anybody in my area. And he had been letting me listen to a tape from a guy in California. And he said, he's going to be at a mini conference over in Danville, Indiana, which is about 80 miles away. He says, I got you a ticket, and you and I are going over there, and I want you to talk to him. And I went over to that mini conference, and him and I met in the bathroom. We exchanged home group T-shirts. My home group at that time was the Sober Hicks and the Sticks meeting. My dad started that meeting, and a couple other guys. And the Sober Hicks and the Sticks meeting was too long to be put on the intergroup meeting list, so they used the first initials of each word, and it come out to Shits Group. So it made that meeting real popular. Everybody wanted to know where to go to the shits. So it grew in size pretty quick with AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen, you know, all going to that meeting. And, you know, the guy that was on that tape, Dave gave me that tape before we went and met him, and he says, I want you to do something for me that you haven't done yet. And I said, what's that? He says, I want you to listen to the similarities instead of the differences. I want you to listen to the similarities of the feelings, not whether you drank or drugged alike, not whether you done this alike. I want you to listen to the feelings. And I thought, man, what kind of garbage is this? You know, going to be one of them tapes about Namah Shiva or whatever. I don't know. I'm going to get spiritual or something. You know, I didn't know what to expect. And my wife and I were divorced. The kids were gone. The only thing I had left was a dog named Boogie. Boogie couldn't wag her tail. Her old body shook when she wanted to wag, and she taught me what you people taught me, unconditional love. You know, my wife and kids left, everybody had left, everybody's telling me to get out, but that dog stayed there. And when we got divorced, we had a big legal battle over Boogie. She got the pit bull, and I got Boogie. And, you know, that dog was an example. I could beat her, kick her, whatever, you know, leave her in the house when I went out on a run, be gone. She'd trash your house, go to the bathroom in the house, and I'd come in, and I'd kick her and beat her and throw her out. And, you know, finally I'd forget about it, and I'd go let her back in. She'd come back in, she'd put her head on my leg, and she'd just wag her tail. See, she taught me what you people taught me. She was trying to do it when I couldn't understand and couldn't see. I know when you can't see and you can't hear, you can't see and you can't hear. That's why I'm grateful. When I was ready and able to be teachable, God put a person in my life that could teach me, that I was willing to follow direction from. I listened to that tape, and he talked about sneaking into his daughter's bedroom at 3 o'clock in the morning and putting his ear down over his daughter's mouth to see if he didn't kill her in a blackout and a whiteout. And I thought, how'd that son of a gun know? How'd he know? Because that's what I done with my son. You know, it's like he is a fly on a wall in my home. He knew all about the physical and verbal abuse and the whole nine yards. We did do a lot of things similar. We rode motorcycles and were involved in a lot of stuff we aren't proud of today. But the more he talked, there was something in his talk on that tape that gave me some hope. And that if he could get clean and sober, maybe I could. And I had the privilege of hearing his wife before that in February at the Indiana State Convention in French Lick in 1989. And in 1990, in March, I got to meet him at that Danville mini conference, and we changed home group t-shirts, and he asked me to do something for him. He said, I want you to call me every Tuesday night at a certain time. I want you to write me and let me know what's going on with you. And anytime that I'm within 600 miles, that you'll come and get eyeball to eyeball with me. And I said, yes, sir. And I started doing that, you know. I'm grateful for that today. I've had the privilege of going to California and spending time with him and his wife and his home group. And, you know, they taught me how to be a father and how to be a husband and how to make them amends. And those are the kind of things that I needed at that time. I don't know about anybody else, but just doing steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 wasn't enough for me. I had to make them amends and get into some forgiveness. And that's a scary deal for most of us, you know, to forgive somebody for doing something to you. See, I always wanted you to forgive me for what I'd done, but I didn't want to forgive you. And my sponsor had given me another book to read into, sermon around a year with Emmett Fox, and Sermon on the Mount, some of the things that the big book was came from. And I found out in there that I couldn't set myself free until I set some other people free. And I'm grateful for that today, you know. Don't get me wrong, just because you get in Alcoholics Anonymous, everything ain't a bowl full of cherries and wonderful, you know. But I'll tell you one thing, just for me, it has continued to get better. It has not gotten worse. My life continues to get better. I've had a lot of things happen to me that most people would think are bad. But with the help of my God and my sponsor and his steps, I realize they have taken me to a different level of better than what I knew before. I had to make them. Before my wife and I got back together, I was pretty new, and I go to meetings, and I was feeling like a third wheel, and I wanted that female companionship, you know, and oh, man. They just tell me no relationships for a year, and I said, I didn't come in here to be a monk. I come in here to quit drinking, and I defied that, you know, and I got involved with a gal, and, you know, we ended up getting engaged. Debbie knew her, heck. She knows that story. There was some stuff that went on, and her and I got together. Right before that, I'd working for a company in Terre Haute. Here I am, I'm a couple, year and a half, 2 years sober, and things are going pretty good. I'm making good money, I'm clean and sober, I'm in a relationship, I think I got it all going on. And I come home one day, and then my mailbox was a letter that thick from my bank. And it had all my checks and stuff where my employer had wrote me bad checks, causing my checks to be bad, and da-da-da-da-da, and I was in trouble. So I done what any good alcoholic will do. I grabbed a .45 automatic, stuck it in my pants, and I went back to work. And I confronted my boss with that .45 automatic and that letter, and I said, I want my money, and I want it now. And I want the $25 for each check that I'm going to have to cover to make good. He said, well, I ain't got that money here. I showed him that pistol one more time, and he said, I'll call my wife, and she'll go get it. Now, that wasn't real spiritual. But I got my money. I went home to my father, and I was telling him, I was cussing, you know, can't trust anybody if it ain't an AA. You da-da-da-da-da. These people are a bunch of crooks. I don't know what I'm going to do. And my dad said, well, why don't you start your own company? I said, what? He said, yeah, why don't you start your own company? So my dad and I started our own company. You don't think we didn't have big egos? My dad got sober 2 years before I did. And he never let me live that down. And we called our company Serenity Steel Erectors. Oh, you tell me we didn't have a big ego? Oh, man. But we got out there and we started doing good. We used the principles of the program to the best of our ability, and we was doing things. Got to doing some big jobs, making big money. For a union contractor, you know, we was doing pretty good. Yeah. We was getting ready to get set up with Fortune 500 magazine. We was doing a hospital, couple hospitals. And I believe God gives us a bank shot, or he did me. See, I got out there trying to climb that material success, and I forgot about being a nobody in AA. And God gave me a bank shot. On June 21st, 1991, I fell off a building. We'd completed the job. We'd already had all our tools pulled off a job. We'd just gotten paid for it. And the main engineer, the main contractor, called me up and said, "Hey, we got a problem." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, the brick lintels that our engineer shot in with a transit are off. The transit was off and we made a mistake. We need you to go down there and cut the brick lintels loose and cut them loose and shoot them back in at the right elevation, weld them back in." I said, "Well, I got all the guys going on another job tomorrow." I said, "I don't know if I can do it." He says, "Well, if you'll come down and do it yourself, only thing you'll need to do is bring your torch and your welder, and we'll have the ladders and equipment there for you." And I said, "Okay." That morning, I went down there and I started cutting them brick lintels loose. And I was climbing a ladder with a welding lead on and a welding hood, going up to weld it back in, and the ladder broke. And I fell and I got impaled on steel rebar sticking up out of the concrete footer. It went through me. And I'm laying there on that footer, and my dad had just pulled in at that time. And we was doing it at a hospital, and the nurses were in having coffee, and they seen it, so they yelled out to the emergency room to send a gurney out to get me, and they come out there, and I'm laying on that rebar, and my dad reached down and picked me up. My dad at that time was 66 years old, and I don't know where he got the strength except God. And he picked me straight up, and he set me down. I said, "I'm hurt bad, ain't I?" He said, "Yeah, you're hurt real bad." And the blood was squirting out, and I said, "Well, I don't want to die like this." He said, "Well, you ain't going to die. God didn't bring you this far to drop you on your head." And next thing I know, they're in there trying to shoot me up and cut my clothes off of me and stuff. And they're hitting me with stuff, and I'm saying, "Well, it ain't doing no good." I says, "I used to do this stuff on the street. My tolerance are a little bit stronger than most people." And they said, "Okay, we'll have to call ahead and get some permission to use this other stuff." They did, and it worked. The last thing I remembered was going out underneath that canopy of that hospital that we had just done, saying to myself, "Boy, we done a real nice job on this." And then I seen the wings of the helicopter, and I knew I was in trouble then. And then for the next 3 months, I was in an induced coma. They didn't know whether I was going to live or die. They pronounced me dead several times. I swelled up to 385 pounds with gangrene poison. My fingers was as big as my wrist. They said I looked like the Michelin man with tubes running in and out of him. Debbie and the people from Alcoholics Anonymous were there to support my mother, my father, and my fiance at that time. They done for me what I could not do for myself. There was more prayers and stuff going on. When I was in that hospital, that guy from California was calling me every day. And they'd put that phone to my ear and he'd say, "Get up off your ass, you ain't gonna die." Click. Of course, I didn't know what he was saying, but everybody told me after the fact. And then one day, he called me and he started running off that stuff. And I answered him and it said, "Jesus Christ." You know, he couldn't believe it. Sort of like the story about the little boy that rode his tricycle, you know. He was riding his tricycle and he come down this hill, just lickety-split, and he hit a chuck hole, boom, fell off a tricycle, got up, said, "Goddamn, son." And the preacher happened to be standing there. The preacher said, "Son, you shouldn't talk like that. Anytime anything bad happens, you ought to say, 'God bless and Jesus loves me.'" So the little boy said, "Okay." He got up, dusted himself off, went back up on top of the hill. Here he come again. Down there, he hit that same chuck hole, lost control, went over and hit a tree, smashed the front wheel all the way up against the axle, fell off, said, "Jesus loves me, and God bless." And that front wheel sprang back just like new, and the preacher said, "Son of a bitch." That's sort of like what Keith done with me when I answered him. You know, it's a crazy deal. You know, I am so grateful for that. You know, I went through that deal, come out of the hospital. I had a feeding tube running through me, and you know, I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I was riding with a motorcycle club at that time, Clean and Sober, called the Fifth Chapter. And them guys would come 50 at a time and have meetings in my room, and the doctors would let them have it. And then he said, finally, go outside on a yard, and they'd wheel me out there, you know. How can I ever repay Alcoholics Anonymous? A trip to Georgia? Hell, I'm getting paid, you know. I get to meet a lot of new people and a lot of new friends, you know. It's a crazy deal, you know. I come in here wanting to be something that I wasn't. And, you know, do you ever go any place and want to be you? I remember going in, "Give me a shot. I want to be something else. I don't want to be me." And come into AA and I find out I got to be me. You know, what a gift, you know. I ain't as bad a piece of junk as I thought I was. That's where I realize that God doesn't make junk out of us. We make junks out of ourselves. And, you know, that gal that I was engaged to at that time, she decided she needed to move on with another buddy of mine in AA. And that's another time where I went hunting in Alcoholics Anonymous. She left and went off with a buddy of mine named Larry, and I jerked that feeding tube out of my gut, and I decided I'm going back to AA. I'm going to find him, and I'm going to take care of this. You know, and the night I got to the meeting where I figured they'd be at, they was there, holding hand in hand, and I went up to the coffee pot. You know, being a thief, you always case things out. So I went to the coffee pot and I looked around and I seen where they was sitting, and I knew I could go around, sit right there across from them, and I could shoot both of them and not hurt nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm there at the coffee pot, and here comes this guy, Dave, that got me hooked up with my sponsor, who don't normally go to that meeting. And he says, "What are you doing here, Grump?" And I said, "Well, I figured I needed a meeting." He says, "What are you doing wearing that leather for? It's awful hot out." I said, I don't know. He said, "Well, I need to talk to you." And I said, "I'll wait until the meeting's over." He said, "No, I need to talk to you now." He said, "I helped you when you needed help, and I need your help now. I want to talk to you." And I said, "Okay." So we went outside of the meeting in the parking lot, and he said, "Give me your gun." Oh. And I said, "What?" He said, "Give me your gun." He started talking to me about forgiveness. And I said, "Okay, here." Gave him a gun. He started talking to me more about forgiveness. And what's another notch on my gun, another scar on my knuckles prove about me being a man? And the more he talked, the madder I got. I had to reach down in my other boot and pull my other gun out and give it to him. Because I was getting ready to shoot him. And he said, "Let's go over to Mickey D's and have some coffee." So I got in his car and we rode over to Mickey D's. And he told me I needed to go home and pick up a pencil and paper and see what part I played in all this. And I thought, "Man, you got to be crazy." He said, "No, if you really want to be forgiven and you want to have a happy, joyous life, you're going to have to forgive them." And I'd already done that with Keith on some other stuff, and you know, I knew that it worked. I knew that it worked because I'd done it on some other stuff. Yet this one seemed a little more personal, a little more deal to me, and I wasn't really willing to give it up. But guess what? The pain was getting great. I was either going to have to drink, drug, or put a bullet in my head. And I'd played Russian roulette before, and I knew what that was. So I went ahead and I done that. I went home and I prayed for God to show me what I needed to see. And I was able to see that I put that gal through 6 months of pure hell. We were engaged, you know, and there was no laughter, no security, no sex, no nothing. No humor, no nothing. Just do for me. I'm the one that's hurt. Fix me. Take care of me. And I got to see that was pretty selfish and self-centered. And I called her up and I asked to meet with her and make amends to her and ask for forgiveness. And she said, "Okay." And we done that. And it worked. The deal with Larry was a little bit harder to do. He was one of the guys that I'd helped get clean and sober. He was married, who left his wife to get hooked up with a gal I was with. I helped him build a motorcycle. I let him come on my property and deer hunt and everything else. And I just had a hard time seeing the thing with Larry. And I finally called Keith up and talked to him. Talked to Dave and a couple other old-timers that I respect in Alcoholics Anonymous. And all of them come up with the same thing. Maybe you need to ask his forgiveness for the fact that you wanted to kill him. And that's all there was. So I done that. I called Larry up and said, "Hey, I want to get together with you, da-da-da-da-da." And he said, "I ain't meeting you no time, nowhere, no anything, bud." And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what. You have 5 or 6 of your buddies come with you. You pick a place in the public, broad daylight, and we'll meet. And I'll come by myself. I'll show you I'm not packing or anything else, and we'll do this deal." And he said, "Okay." So I met with him at a little park down by the river, and I told him I needed to ask for his forgiveness for the fact that I wanted to kill him for what he had done, destroying our brotherhood and trust and that kind of stuff. And he said, "Okay." He said, "But I can't make amends to you for what I done." I said, "Hey, they told me this is about me, not about you." And I said, if it's okay with you, it's done." He said, "Yeah." I got back on my motorcycle. I left out of that park. I headed up First Street, and I hit Highway 63 to the south, runs by the federal prison where I was taking AA meetings in there. And there's a place a little bit south of there, used to be called Dead Man's Curve. I went through Dead Man's Curve 65 miles an hour on that old Harley. And when I got through that curve, it was like the weight of the world had been lifted off my shoulders and I was free. You know. A little bit later, some things happened. Larry left that gal and ended up back with his wife. He called up to ask to make amends to me. And I was told to sort of let it slide. You know, it'll happen on God's time, not to get back into it. That way I won't get hurt again. And I kept trying to put it off and put it off. I was working, doing some other things at that time. Because I'd got injured and had that rebar go through me, I couldn't go back to iron working. It made me an insulin-dependent diabetic. They had gutted me, took all my insides out. So if I got to leave the podium and go to the bathroom, you know why. You know, it's I don't have much control over that kind of stuff, but you know, I got through that, and I was working as an alcohol and drug counselor. I went back to school and got my state and national certification to be an alcohol and drug counselor. I was working for the state prison, an ex-con working for state prison. 1% scooter tramp working for a state prison. That was some difficulties when some of the guys that I used to war against were in there when I'd go in, and they had the tattoos on their bodies like I had on mine, and, you know, they don't forget. One thing they did do because of the program Alcoholics Anonymous, and my God, they respected me that I was clean and sober and doing the right things, and that took away a lot of that stuff. They seen that I was in there trying to help them as well as anybody else. Those are things that was gifts to me by the God that I didn't understand. You know, that all sorts of things happen, you know. I lived through that deal. The forgiveness deal was real important. Today is my grandson Colt's 17th birthday. I called him. He's in Nashville, Tennessee at a conference for the high school kids. He's not affected by alcoholism. His dad went through all the stuff, you know, but so far there's no signs of it coming up in them. Of course, they ain't drank or drugged yet, you know. But Colt's been and my other grandson, Boo's been a real privilege and deal in my life today. Because of my accident in 91, Colt decided he wanted to be a doctor. And he's 17, and he's doing all the stuff now preparing him to go to med school. That's one of the reasons why he's in Nashville, Tennessee this weekend with some beta group or something. Anyway, I could call him, wish him happy birthday today. First thing I did after I'd done my meditations. And talked to my wife, talked to my sponsor. Things that I've been doing ever since I got in this program. At his birthday several years ago, my wife was living in Colorado, and we were divorced, and she came back for his birthday party, and I made my final amends to her of some things that I had totally forgotten. You know, some of that stuff that gets buried way down deep inside until you've grown enough you can't see it. And on this day, I could see it, and I made my final amends with her. And she said, I see a real change in you. See, I had always told her she is the reason why I drank and drugged. She believed it, and she was one of my best barroom buddies. When a lot of the guys had run, when the fights got started, she'd stay. She'd fight with me, you know. We used to beat the hell out of each other and call it foreplay and all that kind of stuff, and, you know. We really went through some stuff, you know. She's got a tattoo of my name on her butt. You know, those were the kind of things that went on to prove in my day that you were something. And today she's one of the greatest treasures I got. When she asked about us dating again and her moving back from Colorado because her job out there was getting ready to close, it scared me. So I called my sponsor and I said, what do I do? He said, the answer's in the big book. I said, yeah. Where? He said, it's in the big book. So I'd start reading that sucker from cover to cover, and I couldn't find it. You know, I'm wanting the answer. I'm wanting to get backed up in some type of relationship. I'm tired of being old and lonely and da-da-da, you know. And finally, I got mad, and I threw this book across the floor. And I'm cussing and thinking, and I said, I can't do the book Alcoholics Anonymous like that. I respect it too much. And I went over and picked it up, and it opened to page 91. Talked about if there be divorce or separation, there should be no undue haste for the couple to get back together. The man should be sure of his recovery. Since the former did not work, this means a new basis and spirit all around. So I called her up and I said, if you want to come back and try it, we'll give it a whirl. But I'm going to tell you, there's conditions. And she said, what? I said, there's conditions. Just like in my drinking and drugging days, I said, you was always third or fourth behind the guys, the motorcycles, all the other stuff. Today, you're going to have to be third or fourth. My God, Alcoholics Anonymous and my guys are more important than you are. Because if I don't have them, I'm not going to have you. My recovery has got to come first. And she came back, and we started. And, you know, it's been a journey. It's been a real journey. I love it when I watch her working with the new gals. And the kids, you know, the Yalatines. I get to love her that much greater when I see her doing that. She's a strong example of recovery. The three favorite words in our home today is call your sponsor. Because we still get into them tiffs and tats, you know, about wanting our way and that. But Dave, because of God and the program Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, we got some tools to use, you know. We took over control of our family liquor store. Sam and I run a liquor store today. It's the only liquor store I know of where you can go in and ask to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. You can reach under, they reach underneath the counter and they pull out a big book or an Al-Anon book and they got meeting lists. You know. It's been a real treat. My mother said she didn't start making a profit in that liquor store until my dad and I quit drinking. So that's one of the living amends that I gotta continue to do. I don't drink, I don't drug, and I don't run. You know, I don't know, it's been a real deal to be clean and sober. You notice that when I got up here, when I've been walking around today, I've walked with a limp. God gave me another one of them bank shots. On June the 3rd of 2006, my home group had a commitment to do the coffee of many conferences in our area. Bo T and Sissy and some of them were coming up to speak, and I was on my motorcycle at 7 o'clock in the morning going up to make coffee, and get that commitment going, and I got run over by a drunk driver, hit and run. Tore my leg almost completely off up above the knee. One of the guys that I sponsored was behind me in his car, and it really tripped his trigger for a while. I'm grateful for my wife that knew me enough that I used to say that if anything happens to me bad enough, just let me die. And she told them to go ahead and take my leg, that she'd rather have a part of me than losing all of me. That deal, for a while, I was pretty angry. I was angry at God, and I was angry at her. And because it's them old ideas that it talks about in the big book, about old ideas, attitudes, and emotions that used to be the guiding force of your life. See, I thought I wasn't a man if I lost my leg. What am I going to do for a living? How am I going to have sex with you? How am I going to be able to take care of you? All them old things started popping back up, and I started judging my value on those kind of things. And God ain't through with you until he's through with you. You know, my value today is to the guys that I work with. We done a family recovery weekend last weekend up home. AA, Al-Anon, Alateen. I had work Saturday, so I missed the Alateen speaker, and I wanted to hear her so bad it wasn't funny, because she's grown a lot. And she talked honestly, you know, about what her life was like. And those are the kind of pleasures that I get today. See, if I'd have cut myself off one more time on my old ideas about what it is to be a success, what it is to be a man, I'd have cut myself small at a miracle. I wouldn't have been able to do the things that I've been able to do and have the blessings that I got. God gives us some difficulties. You know, I think in the third step it says, take away our difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those out of help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. That means I'm going to have some damn difficulties. You know, just because I'm clean and sober doesn't mean everything's going to be damn wonderful, but it's going to be better. If it wasn't better, I wouldn't damn be here. And it'll be better for you if you stay here. That's the hardest part about Alcoholics Anonymous today in my area. They're giving out a whole lot of 30-day tokens, and there ain't guys getting 15 and 20 years no more because they're leaving. Because they're afraid to talk about what's going on with them today with recovery. How you got to be honest about this stuff. Yeah, I'm going to have difficulties. But what am I going to do with them? Can I use them to be of service to you? You know, to help you instead of me getting it? It ain't what I get today. What I get so much more. I mean, I can't, what's that commercial? It's priceless. You know, I got to go turkey hunting with my 12-year-old grandson. It's a wonder his mom lets him go anywhere with Grandpa. Especially with guns. You know, I don't know, it's been a real privilege and an honor to come down here and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. I think that what happened for me is finally when I become teachable and I surrendered. I think in chapter 3 it says, when we concede to our innermost self, this is the first step in recovery. And see, I got that confused with the first step that was up on the wall. I'd come in and read that first step. I'm powerless. But I didn't think I was really powerless. See, when I had my gun underneath your chin and I was picking you up off of your tippy toes, I thought you was powerless. But it had me and I didn't have it. You know, today, I got a little power in my life. I got a little power. I am not powerless over people, places, and things. I'm powerless over alcohol and dope. It says, lack of power was our dilemma. Why the heck would I want to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and remain powerless? That just blows me away today. I got a God of my understanding. I got a sponsor. I got the 12 steps. I got a home group. Guys that care enough about me to tell me the truth. Just because I'm the old timer of the group don't mean I got the answers. There's some days when I need them way more than they need me. So, I don't know. Sort of close with a little story. My grand sponsor used to share about a guy walking down a road on a cold and lonely night. And he come across this poisonous reptile laying in the road. And it was cold, and them reptiles need the warmth to stay alive. And the snake looked up at him with a snickering grin and said, please pick me up and save my life. And the guy looked at him and said, well, you're a snake. If I pick you up, you'll bite me. And I'll die. And the reptile looked up at him and said, no, if you pick me up and save my life, I promise I won't bite you. So the guy thought for a second. He reached down and he grabbed that snake and he stuck him up in his coat. And he started walking towards home. The more he walked, the warmer the snake got. Pretty soon the snake reached out and bit him. And the guy grabbed the snake and threw him to the ground and said, I thought if I saved your life, you promised you wouldn't bite me. And the snake looked up at him with a snickering grin and says, you know what you was when you picked me up. So the next time you reach for a bottle, you want to twist the top, or you want to go for some of them other things, remember what it is when you picked it up. God bless and thank you.